This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today we're in downtown LA, DTLA, at the corner of 6th and Los Angeles streets, at the Red Line Bar.
Hi, I wanted to take you through a walkthrough of Red Line after 10 months of being closed. It's a little eerie.
Oliver Alpuche is giving us a tour of this chic gay bar and lounge that he opened almost 6 years ago.
You know, during the pandemic, I built this stage all by myself, just with a couple gift cards from Home Depot. I wanted to give performers something to look forward to when they come back after this pandemic.
The stage was once a space reserved for drag performers to wow the crowds at Sunday brunch. Now, that space is empty. Red Line is one of many gay bars across LA that's in danger of closing permanently. And those are deeply felt losses. While customers mourn the passing of all kinds of favorite businesses, those providing a safe space for LGBTQ Angelenos represent something special to an embattled community. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo talked with owners of some of those gay institutions who were hoping that when the pandemic ends, they'll still be in business to celebrate.
Oliver Alpuche picks his way around empty wooden tables, chairs, and boxes of alcohol and equipment littered across the floor of Red Line. He's got the bright overhead lights blazing against the bar's baby blue walls, a scene usually only reserved for 2 a.m. crowds, when you don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here.
This was once something so special, and now it's a void. A silence. When people used to fill the dance floor with laughter and cheers and dancing and music and the vibrancy of people coming together, and now it's just silent.
On the far back wall, Oliver gestures towards a pastel-colored, hand-painted mural of three drag performers.
You know, walking through, talking about performances, of Cornbread, Angina, and the beautiful Sasha Colby, painted by David Puck.
To open this bar, Oliver borrowed money, sold his downtown condo, and emptied out his 401k. He and his family built much of the bar themselves. The stage, the counters, they even laid the crown molding. Oliver was even doing well enough, he was able to buy out his business partner. But today, his reality looks much different.
I'm at the point 10 months into this pandemic to truthfully say, I'm not okay. How can you be okay when you literally have been stuck in the rubble of a collapse and there's no end in sight and it's been 10 months?
He's taken out new loans to pay for the overhead expenses that come with running a bar, like water and power.
I owe $80,000 in back rent plus the hundreds of thousands of dollars that I already took out to pay all the rest of the bills throughout the month, to pay off distributors that, like, we can't return the alcohol. It's just sitting in the bar, but you have to pay them. Your term is up, 30 days, 60 days, insurance every month, the electrical bill every month.
Like all renters, Oliver's at the mercy of his landlord, negotiating for more time to pay rent.
It's just a scary thought because it's like, are you going to be next? And it's not based on if I'm willing to fight. It's based on my landlord.
It was pressure from a landlord that did in country western bar Flaming Saddles in West Hollywood. It was a place where hunky guys in cowboy hats and assless chap-wearing dancers performed on polished counters and stripper poles. The bar closed permanently back in August.
As the pandemic got worse, we were like, okay, as long as everyone just stays healthy, we can dig out later. It's just going to be a fiasco of a fiscal nightmare. But let's just stay healthy and dig out on the other side.
That's Flaming Saddles co-owner Jackie Squatriglia. Pre-pandemic, Jackie says she negotiated all financial up and downs with her landlord, Monty Overstreet.
I really was shook and surprised because over the 5 years, we had a great relationship. We paid our rent on time, and whatever he needed from me, I did, and vice versa. And he used to come into the bar, and we had a really good relationship.
Over the summer, as businesses reopened in West Hollywood, Jackie says she was pressured by Overstreet to reopen. Citing the dangers of COVID, she fought against the demand and came to an agreement with him to reopen at a later date. She tells KCRW he later reneged on the agreement and both parties were unable to strike another deal. Overstreet owns other properties that also housed gay bars, like Rage and Gold Coast in West Hollywood and Oil Can Harry's in Studio City. Over the course of the pandemic, all of those businesses have been forced to shut their doors permanently. Overstreet told KCRW he would, quote, rather not comment on the closure of gay bars renting as properties. When these businesses go under, they take out community spaces that have always helped LGBTQ people build community.
These establishments, these bars, years ago, they were a place for people to explore their sexual identity. And when they started, they weren't even safe places, but they were a necessity.
Hunter Fox is a former general manager of the Eagle LA, a Silver Lake gay bar his husband Charlie Matula co-owns. The location has been a gay bar for decades, going by many names. The Shed, The Outcast.
The Eagle was a necessity. People would come there when it was The Shed in 1968, when it was illegal to touch another person. And the reason they went there is because they were trying to identify with other people that were like them.
The Eagle's been closed since mid-March. But unlike many other business operators, the couple owns their building, which means they do still have a mortgage to pay with zero cash flow. Charlie says today they're staying afloat by collecting unemployment. They also received federal funds to help support the bar, like PPP and SBA loans. In the meantime, they miss feeling part of their own community.
We've always been the one throwing the party or setting up the fundraiser or, you know, making it go, and to suddenly just have that switched off is very powerless.
Oliver El Butcher from Redline also feels that same sense of loss. For him, Redline was a way of creating a welcoming and inclusive space for all queer people.
As a kid growing up in Highland Park, there were no queer spaces back then. That we're talking, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And the closest thing that there was WeHo, which was an hour and a half bus ride. And that was, like, to me growing up and wanting to create something better, more accessible, more visible.
Besides the bar, Oliver also founded DTLA Proud, a nonprofit focused on building and sustaining queer communities in the downtown LA area. For Charlie and Hunter, the loss of community isn't just about not being able to gather. Some of their clientele are older and more vulnerable to COVID-19.
The men who used to come to the bar and tell stories of what it was like in the 60s and early 70s to be gay and in a bar, you know, when there was no sign outside. I just feel as if our families being stripped away, our families being diluted, our communities being diluted. And it's almost like our history is it's like it's dying because of this pandemic. There's customers that just aren't coming back because they're dead. And when you meet so many people over so many years and you see them on a regular basis, and then you're instantly cut off from them, and then they're gone.
Yeah, so it's been a rough 10 months.
In the last 2 weeks, both Redline and the Eagle LA have launched GoFundMe campaigns to help pay the bills. They're inspired in part by Silver Lake-based Akbar. A staple of queer nightlife for almost 25 years, Akbar reached out to customers to help them through the pandemic and raise $150,000 in 24 hours. While it's hard to ask for donations for the Redline Bar, Oliver says it's the only way now to keep the safe space he created alive. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Coming up, a new website and newsletter can get hyper-local information to you on the regular. How algorithms can perhaps be a start in replacing disappearing news about your neighborhood. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. As if local journalism hasn't had enough bad news in recent years, the pandemic has made things worse, especially for newspapers. With so many businesses shut down and events canceled, fewer people are buying ads. And ads, of course, are a main driver of revenue. Here in Los Angeles, several papers have closed for good, including the Burbank Leader, the Glendale News Press, and La Cañada Valley Sun. And other local papers, like the Daily News and the LA Weekly, have had to drastically reduce staff and reduce news coverage. USC's Annenberg School of Journalism is trying to reverse that tide, at least inside the city of L.A. Students and teachers there have developed a system of neighborhood newsletters designed to provide hyper-local information to people who live in local news deserts. Journalism professor Gabriel Kahn and his team just launched 110 of these weekly newsletters delivered straight to your inbox, and he's with us right now. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, Steve.
You guys at the journalism school run a website called Crosstown, which we've talked about on this program before, behind this initiative. So let's start there and tell us a little bit about Crosstown and what it does.
Sure. So what we're really trying to do is address that situation you just described, where we have these expanding news deserts. That's areas which receive no regular news coverage, which has an impact on civic engagement, on the connectedness that residents feel with their city, with their community. And we're trying to find a new way to approach that, to address that, one which also addresses one of the problems that you outlined, which is the fact that it's so difficult for local news organizations to derive revenue. So the way that we do it is that we collect vast amounts of data about Los Angeles, about all these sort of quality of life issues, from traffic to crime to weather and the building environment and things like that. And we store it in a large database, and then we sort it by neighborhood so that we can give people a kind of view of what is happening in their neighborhood on these issues and how that compares to the city at large and to other neighborhoods across town.
There's a newsletter for every neighborhood, 110 of them, as we mentioned. If I say live in Koreatown, what news would I get in mine? I mean, it's specifically driven by these neighborhoods.
Right. So we have developed a system together with the Viterbi Engineering School at USC where we can automatically generate news about Koreatown, about Silver Lake, about Los Feliz, about any neighborhood in the city of LA, and serve up stats about that neighborhood in the form of a newsletter. So in Koreatown, we could tell you, you know, how many traffic accidents were there in 2020 compared to 2019, or how many building permits for new buildings were requested in Koreatown and how that compares to other neighborhoods around the city as well. Trying to give people some of this basic information that helps them get a sense of how their neighborhood is faring, gives them a sense of critical information that really hopefully will lead to a better quality of life.
I mean, it's so interesting to me because, you know, one of the things that I used to do when I was early on in journalism, and we're talking decades ago, is, you know, I'd go to work at the radio station, and one of the first things I would do was call police departments around the region and find out, you know, what happened where, how many traffic accidents were there, are people in the hospital, things like that. Really basic information, and it sounds like what you guys are doing is very similar to that.
Absolutely. The only difference is that we're really trying to do it in such a way that we reduce the costs involved in producing that. With you, you know, as a reporter calling around, there's a lot of friction involved, there's a lot of time involved, and as a consequence, a lot of costs involved. We're trying to sort of replace that function with data that is generated automatically. And of course, there are humans involved in the process, but we're trying to do that in such a way so that we can create local news at scale. That is, rather than just have one person cover one neighborhood, we can have one system cover every neighborhood, which is 110 neighborhoods throughout the city of LA, from San Pedro to Chatsworth.
With this project, it seems pretty ambitious. What do you hope will become of this? Do you see more of this happening in the future?
Yes, and really what we're trying to do is, first of all, we see a value in journalism. We see a civic value. What we don't see is a value that's recognized by the current marketplace. That is, in an environment, a digital environment dominated by Google and Facebook, it's very difficult for any news publication of any size to eke out a living. A few, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they've been able to do that. But at the local level, it's increasingly difficult. And we're trying to basically understand this current system that we have of digital distribution of content and devise a reporting system that's better suited to that, so that we can sort of create a new type of publication that does some, if not all, but some of the sort of basic functions that an old community newspaper might have done in the past.
Well, I mean, and one thing that journalism does, obviously, is talk to people, right? And this is something that you guys aren't doing. You're actually taking, you're extrapolating these numbers, right? And you're putting them out in these newsletters in different neighborhoods. So you're not talking to people. Do you think maybe we lose something in the journalism community by not doing that? Or is this just a different way?
Absolutely. Listening to people is a core function of journalism. What we're doing with this system is that this enables us to look at the entire city as a whole and then be able to zero in on areas which have a particular relevance. So, for example, we can figure out that Van Nuys has some of the greatest number of traffic accidents in Los Angeles. And we can do that in a matter of moments. But once we've done that, then we can call people in Van Nuys. We can call the neighborhood council representatives and so on and so forth and try to understand what that situation is. So we're hoping that that can help start a conversation in those communities, so people there can address some of the concerns that they might have. It's very difficult to take a complaint to your city councilman or something like that if you don't have the data to back it up. And so in a certain sense, what we're hoping to do is give people the stats that they need in order to be that squeaky wheel to advocate for themselves in their community.
Gabe Kahn, professor over at USC's Annenberg School for Journalism and the developer of Crosstown Newsletters. Gabe, thanks.
Steve, thank you so much.
And by the way, you can sign up for the neighborhood newsletter over at Xtown LA. That's X, the letter X, TOWN.LA. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. From hyper-local news to the big California political picture, and it has a big connection to Orange County. With everything else going on, pandemic and vaccines, impeachment, you may not have the news bandwidth for the effort to recall California Governor Gavin Newsom, but there is a campaign there to do just that. A campaign that claims to have collected more than 1.2 million signatures, and it's being driven mostly out of OC. Sounds like it's a good time to check in with Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, and every week he's here for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
This is a recall campaign with a lot of fingers pointing to Orange County. Who's behind it?
Oh, anyone who fits into the rogues galleries of Orange County Republicans. So, you know, you have honorary chairs ranging from the current OC GOP chair, Fred Whitaker, to former OC GOP chairs, Supervisor Don Wagner, former Anaheim Mayor Kurt Pringle, even going back into the old school, like Dick Ackerman, who used to be a state senator from Fullerton. Basically, any Republican who wants to pretend that there's still something are signing up to go after Newsom.
The LA Times, Gustavo, over the weekend reported that the campaign, quote, allied with radical and extreme elements early on to help collect signatures. What do you know about that?
That they're following the Orange County GOP playbook going back to the 1960s. I mean, you know, the 1960s birchers were the anti-immigrant zealots of the 90s. are the QAnons and, you know, states' rights of today. That wasn't really surprising. It was great, you know, great coverage, of course, by my colleagues at the Times. Paige St. John was one of them. But it's not surprising at all. And, of course, the leaders behind the recall will say, well, there's not really anything we could do. It could be, you know, we have a broad coalition of people who are supporting this recall. But, of course, what they're not doing is condemning some of these wacko views of some of the very organizers within the ranks. It's not just people signing the petition. It's actual organizers who have some of these beliefs.
Well, let's talk about the signing of the petition, though, because the group behind the effort says they have 1.2 million signatures. They need close to 1.5 million, right, by March. Are they going to get there? Because March 17th is the specific day. That's right around the corner, right?
Look, a lot of people do not like Newsom, and it's not just conservatives, liberals, progressives. Newsom, of course, blew it for himself forever when he went to the French Laundry and violated, what was it, three points of his stay at home. He didn't stay at home. He ate with people who were not members of his family. He ate indoors, and he ate without a mask. Wait, that's four right there. So I wouldn't discount it, and this is an interesting thing. People have been trying to recall Newsom almost from the moment he entered office, and all of those failed miserably. This is the one that not only has a fighting chance, but it's either going to make it or going to be very, very close.
I mean, the thing about it is a recall would be an off-year election, right? And people who have a skin in the game, as it were, tend to do better in off-year elections than, say, when everybody votes, right? And everybody's paying attention.
If it gets to a recall, I do think Newsom will be recalled just because he really doesn't have many fans right now. But this is the problem with the advocates for the recall. Who would be his replacements? Because there's nobody in the GOP who could possibly win a statewide election. The closest would be former San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner, who's somewhat moderate. But I bet you if they take out Newsom, you know there's going to be a Democrat who's going to be even more progressive than him who would beat Faulkner in a heartbeat. So be careful what you wish for, as the old proverb goes, because it just might come true.
The Democrats, or some Democrats, got in trouble for calling it a coup about the time of the Capitol insurrection. And there was this, you know, finger pointing going back and forth saying, hey, look, you can't call that a coup. This is, you know, the initiative and referendum process is legal in California, and you can recall a governor should that be necessary. I wonder how seriously Democrats are taking this.
Oh, they're starting to take it seriously. I mean, and the calling it a coup was just absolutely dumb. And it's typical Democrats underestimating their opponents, overestimating their abilities, and then shooting themselves not just on the foot, but also on the tongue as well. So Newsom is saying, oh, I'm not even focusing on that. I'm just focusing on coronavirus or whatnot. But you're starting to hear the chatter. People are knowing that, okay, this is going to get close. So we got to govern a little bit better, or at least not eat at the French Laundry anymore.
You think this is the reason why we're seeing the state drop the stay-at-home orders?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think it has to do with the fact that he has this intense political pressure?
Yeah, I do think so. I know Newsom is saying, okay, we're seeing projections, and cases are going down in California. They have been for the past couple of weeks, but coronavirus is still out there. Newsom needs some sort of publicity that's good for him, any sort of publicity. So leaving it to the counties to decide whether the people could dine outside, he thinks it's going to be a win-win, but the people who hate him, they're not going to care. They, you know, blood is in the water for them, so they're going to go out there and just try to recall him and get him out of California politics forever. And of course, the sad part with this is that we also had this pressure during the summer, also coming from Orange County, by the way, people protesting against lockdowns and whatnot. Newsom somewhat unscrewed the mandates, and of course the cases went up. So just be careful, Newsom. Do not take the recall unseriously. I know that's a double negative, but it's okay. But also, you still have to govern the state, and you still have to govern for the state's future, not just your future.
LA columnist Gustavo Arellano with this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
By the way, at his news conference today, and in response to a question about whether dropping stay-at-home orders statewide has anything to do with the growing recall campaign, Governor Newsom called that thought, quote, complete and utter nonsense. So there's that. That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, it'll be a year since we lost Kobe Bryant. What it's been like trying to memorialize him during a year of fast-spreading virus. That's tomorrow. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Tell us how you're doing. Get some things off your chest if you need to. And how you're making it through this pandemic. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Tom, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on tonight's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Stay safe. Thanks for your ears. Have a great night.